This is Alan Precious, recorded individually at Sanford in Cumbria by Chris Eldon Lee on the 29th of October 2010. Alan Precious. Alan, I want to talk to you mainly about your two trips after Hope Bay.
Yes.
But there's one question that remains from last night, and that's about eating dog's liver. How did that come about?
It came about because some of the dogs and puppies had to be put down because they were runts or because of some illness in one of the dogs, something like that. And Julian, I think, and Paul Massey, perhaps. No, I think this was in Julian's first year. I'm not quite sure about that.
This is Julian Taylor.
Did an autopsy and took out the liver of the older animal, I think it was, and brought it in and cooked it. It was cooked and we all ate bits of it with the rest of our lunch. And it tasted like other kinds of animal liver.
So do you feel comfortable about that?
It was an experiment. We probably thought we were doing it partly for science or partly because it was something to eat.
What about dog management generally? Because the survival rate of dogs was about 50%, wasn't it?
I don't know about that.
Well, there's quite a lot put down at birth.
Yes.
Mainly the females.
That is true. Some dogs, yes, death at birth is probably the biggest thing. And I remember later at Halley Bay, I looked after the first pups that were born there. And I seem to remember that we actually put some of them down because we didn't want so many bitches. That I think that was the policy at Hope Bay too.
Yes.
We didn't want a lot of bitches because it was thought they weren't as good at pulling a sledge as the male dogs were. And usually there were probably 8 male dogs and only one bitch in a team. One bitch in the front pair to encourage the males at the back to go forward. Yes, I had forgotten that actually, that we did put down a lot at birth. Some, I don't think many actually died naturally at birth. They were put down, just not kept.
What was the feeling about that? Because the bond between AFID and the dogs was quite strong, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
This rather goes against the intuition, doesn't it?
Yes, I can remember Derek Clark commenting on this, saying, poor little thing, you're not going to be allowed to live. So there was a feeling, yes, that it was a shame. But I don't know. It might have been a reflection on the times of the world generally. That if you weren't going to be any good, there was no point in your being left alive sort of thing.
A kind of post-war hard harshness?
I don't know. Possibly. It's not altogether natural, although in nature, again, it probably does happen, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Nature red in tooth and claw.
Mary Webb.
Mm.
Yeah.
So.
And within the last decade, you'd all lived or even fought in a war where death was fairly commonplace.
death was occurring often, yes, it was, yeah. Mm.
Were there some FIDs who couldn't bring themselves to witness this or help with
it? I don't know whether... I'm not sure. It wasn't everybody's job, of course. I think it was Derek's partly. And so not the others wouldn't be involved personally in carrying it out.
Yeah.
They would know of it going on, but not being involved in actually doing it.
Right. And do you know how they were put down?
Usually drowning, I think. Mm. Yes, drowning.
Let's leave that there, if we may. Mm. Thank you very much for answering mm-hmm. those points. It's something that I've asked a few times and got quite strong answers from people.
I was going to say, you need to ask other people as well.
Don't worry. You did your 2 years at Hope Bay,
mm-hmm.
and then you came back to England.
Yes.
And as we heard in the previous recording, you had to go back to the bank.
Yes. Yes.
Which must have been a bit frustrating, wasn't it?
It didn't have any effect because I knew that I was going to be going south again in 6 months' time, and I needed to do something, obviously, to earn some money whilst I was back at home. So no, that was a good point of being self-servant, I think.
Bit of a respite for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when you went south again, you went to Admiralty Bay.
Yes.
And this time you were promoted.
Yes, I was, yeah.
How did that happen?
Unexpectedly. on the way down, my feeling is that on the way down, we were being assessed by ship's captain, Norman Brown, and so on. Plus they had my record and our records from my previous 2 years down there. They needed someone to go to Admiralty Bay. They needed someone as a base leader. My companions who went with me were all entirely new FIDs. None of the FIDs at the base already there were staying. It was a complete changeover. So we were an entirely new family of FIDs at Admiralty Bay. We originally were going to have, I don't know, an extra radio operator because the island was going to be resurveyed. Also, Hugh Noble was going down to do glaciology, which meant spending a lot of time on the West Stenhouse Glacier and very regular visits to the glacier. So you needed three people at least, two people to accompany him each time he went on to the glacier. Very shortly after we got there, FIDS decided that the radio control, which was at Lockroy, was going to come to Admiralty Bay, because they said the radio traffic interfered with their ionospheric program.
And vice versa.
Yes. And this was a saddening thing for me. I didn't want anything to do with control radio.
Why not?
Well, because it meant taking up people at the base. We had to have the chief radio operator collecting, and we had a second radio operator to take over from him occasionally. It seemed to me to interfere with a program of exploration that we were supposed to be doing. That was my feeling. I suggested that they should put it at Deception Island instead.
So there was negotiation, was there?
there was a suggestion which was quickly killed by saying it would interfere with the flying program there, which of course it would. So there we are, we had it. And we got on with it. I wasn't interested in the radio side of the business myself, other than the necessary skeds for weather reporting and, you know, the usual messages.
Right. When you were, however, you had to put up with it, didn't you?
Yes, we had to put
up. Did you resent it for all your time there?
No.
Got used to it.
Just got on with it, yeah. Hmm.
Didn't it also mean that you were the centre of gossip?
In what way?
Well, you were aware of all the messages going to and from everywhere.
Oh. Well, the radio operator was. Occasionally he came out and told us things, but I certainly never scrutinised all the signals that came through, not by any means, no. Okay.
How were you made base leader? What was the procedure?
It was put to me that they decided this is what they would like me to do,
yeah.
Frank Elliott and the governor, I suppose. And
so you were in the Falklands at the time, were you?
Yes, this is as we arrived
from
the Bisco, we all went up to Government House, FID's office for various bits of documentation and so on. And it was put to me then by Frank Elliott. I'm not absolutely certain whether it was Frank or Johnny Green, it was put to me, and I couldn't see any reason to object. It was a surprise, and I accepted, yes.
And there was a ceremony?
There's a ceremony of being sworn in as a local magistrate. I think I'd already signed the Official Secrets Act several times by then. That was it. I was told who my companions were going to be, and we all gathered together down on the deck of the Bisco, and we already knew each other from travelling down, so we thought, oh, well, I think we can all get on with each other, and as indeed we could. I think it allowed some people to say, for instance, I did hear someone saying, well, I'd like to go to so-and-so base, and I heard someone else say, well, if he's going there, I'm not going there. So yes, it was. It was a good sorting out process. Yes, it was.
Did you have any particular feelings when you were standing there being invested, or whatever the phrase is?
A feeling of responsibility, yes, certainly. And wondering exactly what it might be like to be a magistrate. Fortunately, I never had to practice doing anything of the kind. I already knew, of course, of the business at Deception, where they'd had to have a court of inquiry in which the base leader obviously was a magistrate, as was Captain Johnson.
This was after the death of Farrant.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. So I certainly hoped I'd never have to do anything of the kind like that. Part of being also sworn in was sworn in as a local receiver of wrecks. And we never had any wrecks that I could receive or obtain any, what do they call it, not contraband, but bounty from something that had been wrecked. No.
Was there a Bible involved in this process?
Yes, of course, yes. I swear by Almighty God, yes. Mm.
So what was your style then? Did you adopt a particular approach? Having been under two bass leaders at Hope Bay, you had something to compare yourself to.
Yes, I knew that I was nothing like Bill Anderson, because he was trained to be a manager. I was probably nearer to Bill Turner, I suppose. I think you might get a better picture of what I was like by asking some of my former colleagues.
My question, though, was did you consciously adopt a certain style? Did you have a relaxed, hands-off style, or were you a micromanager?
What I think I tried to do was to make it possible I tried to help the specialists, such as Hugh Noble, the glaciologist, and Graham Davy, the surveyor. I tried to make it possible for them to do their jobs well, to support them, to make sure, for instance, that Graham could get out wherever he wanted to go, and that he would be supported by me and others, and that I would see that he always had plenty of stores so that he could carry on working.
So the science came first?
I think so, yes.
You mentioned a little while ago that the island was to be resurveyed. I'm wondering why there was a need to resurvey it.
It was in connection with the aerial survey that was going on, the FIDASI aerial survey done by Huntings. They were doing aerial mapping, aerial photography, and the job of Graham Davy was to fix certain points on the ground, which he did by star sight and triangulation, which is, as you probably know, a very slow business. Early in my time there, four of us went to nearby Nelson Island so that Graham could triangulate from Duthoir Point to Harmony Bay. And this involved him and us planting stakes in the ice, which he would survey from Duthoir Point. And I often think that from above, what the two pairs of us were doing must have looked like a ritual dance, because we were sledging first this way towards each other, then away, and then coming back towards each other again, all the way from Edgell Bay to Harmony Cove.
It's like two swans mating.
Yes.
Mating ritual.
Something like that. Yeah. Yes. Later, we had one team of dogs there and one dog sledge. They were not able to be used a great deal because all summer long there was no sea ice and there was just shingle on the shore, so you couldn't really drag a sledge on shingle. But we discovered a way up onto the ice cap, and we backpacked tons of stores up there and dragged the sledge and the dogs up, so that we made a couple of dog sledge run from there along to towards the end of Escura Inlet and Potter Cove. And Graham and Robin Stevens climbed up the hill, I've forgotten what it's called, three buttresses or something like that, quite steep hills, and they took sightings from there and linked up with Nelson Island.
So the sledging wasn't anything like as adventurous or satisfying as...
It wasn't. There was no such thing as that you could do 100 miles a day or anything like that. You couldn't do long distances dog sledging. Mm. It was more we had to backpack and man-haul slower business altogether and different business altogether. Yeah.
You had Fidarsi personnel on base with you,
yes, we did, yes. Jim Rennie, a former FID, and John Cheel, and someone else, who was it?
Colin Brown.
Colin Brown, that's right. They were there, along with someone whose name I forget, who was a member of Hunting's Aero Services. They did some quick sledging routes and man hauling routes. They also had a rubber boat, which I don't think they used very often, but they had a kind of skiff, big. I think it was an ex-army, one of these collapsible dinghy kind of things, with an ATCO lawnmower engine on the back. And we also, of course, we had the two 12-foot wooden dinghies, and together we did a bit of, quite a lot of boating, really, in the area. Yes, we had I can't quite remember how long they were there.
They didn't stay for the winter then?
No. They just did the time they needed to be there to do their own theodolite work. I remember with Jim Rennie climbed Turnick Needle and took me up behind him twice, and which was a very shaley sort of volcanic core, I think. And we went to the top of it, and he took sightings on Bridgman Island and various points around. Yeah.
So it sounds like you had about a dozen men in the summer.
Yes, more than a dozen. Mm.
More. Mm.
Yes, the permanent lot was 8.
And that was because it was IGY year, so you had rather more than...
Yes, that's right.
Admiralty Bay would normally have.
Yes, that's right, we did.
How did the activities of the of IGY actually impinge on your routine at Admiral?
Well, I would say it was a major part.
Really?
Yes, because the certainly Hugh Noble's glaciology program was part of a worldwide study of glaciers and what was happening to them, and his work was very interesting. We planted flags on various lines across the glacier, and each 10 days or so we would travel out and measure what had happened. And he also took sightings along the ice cliff to check how much had gone in the season, the melting season. And also, he and I and Robin Stevens dug a deep fern pit in the upper part of the glacier, from which you could check the temperatures as we went down and the condition of the ice, whether it was melted together and so on, rather like the business of tree rings, where... a wide ring, I think, means a hot summer, and the nearer together, colder seasons, something like that. But obviously you'd have to speak to him to get a more scientific picture of that.
So compared to Hope Bay, where you were very isolated, suddenly here you were part of an Antarctic-wide initiative, really, with much better communications.
Well... I don't know. I don't look at it that way. No. In a way, we were more isolated than Hope Bay because we didn't have any neighbours.
Mm.
We had occasional visitors. Chilean ships came in sometimes, and there were Argentinian ships in the vicinity. In fact, also there, they had a couple of people on Defile Islet, I think, in Escura Inlet, doing, I don't know, geology, something like that, whom we didn't know were there until the first mate of the Shackleton told us, and he went ashore and gave them a protest note.
The work you were doing on the glaciers and ice movement and so on, did any of the results surprise you? Was it?
No, didn't surprise me at the time, no. I found them very interesting, and I may not have been sufficiently knowledgeable to judge what significance anything might have. I just looked at them and found them very interesting, really. And it did not occur to me that it might be part of, when there was a melt, it didn't occur to me that it might be part of a more permanent in inverted commas, melt or climate change. I wasn't sufficiently aware of such an idea. I did later, when I went to Halibay, I read about climate change, and I've been aware of it ever since.
So by the time you got to Halley in 61, the phrase climate change was in the vocabulary, was it?
I don't think it was in the general vocabulary by any means.
But the scientists were talking about it.
Scientists should have been. I read about it in a very good book by a German meteorologist, can't remember his name, but the book was called Earth's Envelope. And this was very instructive to me about the atmosphere and the great value of the rainforests as carbon sinks, so that nowadays it hurts me when I hear of the rainforests being chopped down.
But back at Admiralty Bay, the measurement of the ice movements, that was purely to find out. It wasn't because anybody was suspicious of any large scale change.
Yes, that's right. It was to do with how quickly it built up and how it went down. Similarly, at the same time, we did, when the sea ice formed, we measured every day, I think, or every other day, the thickness of the ice. We had, I think it was a handmade wooden thing with like a pole with a shoe on the end, which we put through a hole and brought up to the underneath edge of the ice and measured how thick it was. We did so. That was quite an interesting way of doing things in connection with ice.
What else can you tell me about your time at Admiralty Bay? I gather there were one or two rather interesting boating trips.
Yes, at least two. With the Fidassi people, we were travelling across to what I called Tern Coast, because the Terns used to fly there, and it wasn't terribly far from Turning Needle. We got over halfway, and the Seagull engine suddenly stopped. it was out of petrol. Adrian Wenzi Walker, who was a very good an excellent boatman, refilled the engine, refilled the tank with petrol, but the plugs had got wet and it wouldn't start, so he had to take them out and dry them. And by this time, we were in a strong current heading out towards Turnick Point. The point opposite Point Thomas. Heading out to sea, instantly my thoughts were on these other people from a few years previously who'd had to spend a night there. Point Henniken is what I'm talking about. Jim Rennie and his crew came after us in the collapsible canvas boat with the Atco lawnmower thing on the back. They came towards us, and they were coming straight at us, and the Atco lawnmower thing would only turn in an enormous circle. You couldn't make a tight turn with it. So I thought, well, we're going to crash in a minute. Anyway, they just scraped past us without hitting us, and we continued to drift. And then suddenly the engine burst into life. So we were rescued. We got back to shore.
So you were not rescued by a lawnmower then?
No. We got onto the shore and carried on with our business of lugging stores up the hill and helping Jim and his party.
Did your life flash before you?
No. It I had a feeling of great frustration, that's all.
When something like that happened, would you discuss it with the team afterwards and say, this is how we make sure that doesn't happen again?
No, I don't think so. I always try to take precautions, and I believe in the base leader's manual. I'm not absolutely certain, but I believe it may suggest that when you are out in a boat with the Seagull engine, have the spare Seagull engine in the boat with you. Well, I'm quite sure we never did that. We had them on separate dinghies. I don't know anyone who might have followed that advice. I don't know.
What was the second dodgy boating moment?
Second dodgy one was with Adrian Wenzi Walker. We'd been over to Point Thomas and also further up into Eskara in the taking stores in support of Graham Davies' survey. And we came back and we were very close to the ice cliffs that lead up towards Cape Crepin. And the sea became very, very choppy, and also a strongish wind heading straight at us, which was lifting the front of the boat completely out of the water. So I had to climb forward and sit in the bows of the boat. And each time we rose up over a wave, I had to plonk down to try and get it down again. And we must have gone through that for quarter of an hour or 20 minutes, something like that. And then all of a sudden we came completely out of it into more or less a flat calm. So this was obviously a local wind and the sea obviously pushing up against the ice cliffs and bouncing back again and causing this choppiness. I've likened it to the upside down bit of an egg box, like little hillocks we were in amongst all the time.
Little pyramids all around you.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's right. I've never seen a sea like it anywhere in any other situation.
And so you were using your body as human ballast?
Yes, yes, yes.
And was that something that you read in the manual, or was it just something that came to you at the moment?
It was something that Adrian probably had a lot to do with, that because he was a boatman.
So he was...
And he was a good boatman.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
Got some news for you, Alan. This is what you do.
Yes.
You must have got soaked.
Yes. Yes, fairly wet. Mm.
Yeah. Mm. May we move on to Harry?
Yes.
If we may, because you did that year at Admiralty Bay, then again you came home.
Mm.
And I think, again, back to the Post Office Savings Bank.
Yes, that's right.
So what brought about the third term?
It might have been, I think it was something to do with, I was a bit unsatisfied with what I was doing, really. Not getting on as well as I hoped I might in the savings bank. I think maybe, I don't know, it must have been a nuisance for them, me going off and coming back again. Not to say that they weren't absolutely fair with me, I'm sure they were. I was a bit unsettled, so I went for another. I wrote to see if there was a chance for me to go down again. And eventually Bill Sloman sent a telegram and said there was a place at Halibay if I would like it, and I'd need to go and do a radio sonde course at Hemsby in Norfolk, which that's what eventually happened. I went there.
So although you've done two terms of being a Met Man, radio sondes were new to you?
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. So, sorry?
Yes, radio sonde was new to me, and I found that very interesting, really, and met some nice people there, some of whom came down with me to Halibay.
This is where you have to launch balloons.
Yes.
Is that right? I gather that was an interesting experience.
Yes, yes. We had an enormous cylinder in a hut, which we had to fill up with a certain amount of aluminium pellets, I think they were, and something else, a mixture of something that looked like soda crystals, soda of some kind, which with water formed hydrogen and filled a balloon, filled a measured amount into a balloon, which the balloon lifted off weights off the floor, and then it was ready to go. We attached to it a little transmitter, a battery-filled transmitter with a little windmill on, which signalled down to us temperatures and wind speed and so on. This was tracked by radar, and we plotted the track of the balloon and its instrument on a graph and obtained a picture of the upper air conditions.
You were following it with the theodolite, were you?
It was followed by radar.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm.
Yes, there were two radar sets at Halley, the XRAF things, and there were two radar operators who tracked it, and we Met Men down below in the Met Office down under the ice followed it on a radar, on a screen.
How did you launch them then? Was that an interesting experience?
The normal way was to launch the balloon and its canister, which was on the end of a long piece of string, through a hatch in the roof. And the trick was to not let the canister hit the roof as it went out, otherwise it might put it out of action. I think we always managed not to hit the roof. But in very windy weather, you couldn't do that. We had to stand outside with the canister, holding the canister, and let the balloon lift up the string. But in strong winds, of course, the balloon went along parallel, more or less, with the ice. So we had to run at quite a speed and throw the canister into the air at the right moment so that it wouldn't hit the ground. This was occasionally very difficult. You couldn't always guarantee not to grange the canister, as we used to call it. And it was a sickening moment when this happened, because you had to go through all the business again. And I think I remember an odd day when we did this several times until the boiler thing got too hot. We couldn't put any more stuff in it. It was too hot. We had to wait till it cooled down. Yes, it was good fun.
Was this daily or once a week or?
Every day we did that, yes.
All the year round?
Yes, I don't think, I'm pretty certain that we never missed a day. And obviously, on some days, we had to do it more than once, as I've said.
Right. Halley's a bigger base than the others.
Yes.
And some of the Fids regard it as a Cinderella base because there's less beauty attached to being at Halley. How would you assess it?
It was certainly very different. What I missed about being at Halley was there was no sight at all of any rock or anything other than ice. And also, partly because of this, you could never go out without wearing goggles, sun goggles. There were good things about it in that there were a huge number of people, so that you'd never got tired of anyone. And also, you were never thrown too closely together with anyone whom you might not have wanted to be, you know. But we gathered together as a base certainly every Saturday to watch a film. We had a number of films which we got to know off by heart, certainly. Some of them. I remember one of them was Pal Joey with Frank Sinatra, and one of the scenes in this was some showman or other was running a club, and Frank Sinatra approaches him and said, "I want a job as a singer in your club." And this actor, whoever he was, I'm not quite sure, he said, "Singer? I don't have singers. I'm running a girl show. Legs, not tansels." And we used to repeat things like this to each other.
So lines from the films entered daily conversation, didn't they?
Yes, that's right. And we also had meals together, of course. We had good meals together, midwinter dinners and so on. Very good indeed.
Socially, did the base kind of divide up into cliques?
Not to any great extent, I don't think, no. People's particular jobs brought them into contact with each other. I think, for instance, the ionosphericist and Stuart Marsden's business with the aerials, the radio astronomy, were very much together. And I think also Mike Thurston's biology and Dennis Ardus glaciology and came together a bit, because partly because of their offices being next to each other. The builders, they obviously all worked together and knew each other, and of course we all helped them in building the new hut. We all got on extremely well together, I think. The pups, as they came along, brought people close to each other in some ways because they were interested in the dogs and the pups. Things like that.
How did it take to living underground?
Surprisingly easily, really. I wasn't looking forward to that, going down below, but really when you were downstairs you didn't realise that you were underground, I think, you know. Had to climb up these ladders to get out and do the metobs and so on, read the thermometers and so on. We had also had to have guide ropes from the top of the, occasionally from the top of the hatch towards the thermometers and towards the balloon hut and the radar, so on. But no, I very quickly got used to living underground. Didn't seem unusual at all. It was an experience in that as you went, particularly as you left the hut and you came to the foot of a ladder and you went up a sort of snow cave appearance up to the top until you went through the hatch. It was quite a funny experience, but it was good, really.
There was attempts to find new routes out of Halley, wasn't there? And you tried to pioneer a route which wasn't entirely successful. This is with David Eastie.
Dave Eastie and Eric Jones and John Skilling. John Skilling and I sledged together, and Dave Eastie and Eric Jones with a team. I don't think we didn't have entirely full teams at that time. I'm not quite sure why. We had less than 9 dogs each in the teams. But we followed the ice cliff down from Cape Roll, Cabo Roll, down towards where the ice edge joins the inland sea at the Dawson-Lambton Glacier. The Dawson-Lambton ice stream, as it's known now, forms the edge of the ice shelf where it joins the inland ice. And the year before us, some man haulers had found a route across this. It's a great chasm, really. They'd found a route across and got onto the inland ice. John Skilling and the rest of us found another route across, near, as I say, near the entrance of the glacier into the Weddell Sea. We found a route across and ran along the inland ice, ran along very well. It's in huge waves of ice, and we ran along these until we came to where the previous year's party had made a crossing. We crossed there, and then we continued along the limit of the ice shelf up to what was called the gin bottle, the McDonald Ice Rumples, and then sledged back to base. So we did a pretty big circular tour of the ice shelf.
And the function of that was to?
It was to see the limits of the shelf, and certainly to try and find a route across. We had made other attempts, Dennis Ardus and Colin Johnson and myself and Dave Eastie again, had made several exploratory journeys to the Dawson-Lambton ice chasm to try and see a route across, but all we came across, all we came to was huge cliffs and chasms and broken jumble of ice in the bottom. So although John Skilling and I found this route across, I don't think it's ever been used again. It was in the wrong place. Mm. Colin Johnson and Dennis Ardus found a route much further north towards the Totten Mountains where they visited.
Were there other notable events that year? Anything that went seriously wrong? Or?
The aurora was very good. We had some very good sights of the aurora. Amazing, really. And I and several others spent a month or so with Mike Thurston down in Penguin Bay, where Mike was studying the emperor penguins. His work, I think, was following up from that done by Dr. Wilson in 1914, whenever it was. And we occasionally had emperor penguin omelettes as a result of that.
Did any of the penguins ever appear at base? They might not bring some back.
I think so. I think occasional ones did manage to go as towards the base, but I'm sure they were lost. If you know the ones that we did, mainly they were down in a huge rookery, as they were called, and I'm sure Mike Thurston estimated how many there would have been. I can't remember a figure, but it was into thousands anyway.
But you don't remember any actually inside Halley in the buildings.
One might have been brought in. I'm not sure. I think Mike might have had one into. Yes, I think he did. To do a, I don't know, right. An examination. Yes, mm. Yes, I'm sure he did.
Sounds like it was a fairly calm and collected year for you, after all the trials and troubles of...
Yes.
And also, of course,
It was, I would say that, yes.
And was it okay not being base leader?
I hadn't really expected to be base leader. I was King Fid on the way down with Captain Hindberg on the...
On the Kistadan.
On the Kistadan. He used to call me Presley because he couldn't pronounce precious, and the steward, the chief steward who saw to our meals every day, he always used to call me Mr. Precious.
You must have been one of the most more dog experienced men at Halley that year.
I think so. Colin Johnson obviously had done more down at W, and I'm not sure whether he was at Adelaide. He certainly was at W with Angus Erskine, who of course was a dog man from Greenland. Mm.
And you had some Greenland dogs, didn't you?
We had some Greenland dogs, as well as some Canadian, yes. Yes, we brought the first lot of dogs to Halley Bay. Some came directly from Greenland. Some had been born in Denmark on the way down from Greenland to the Antarctic. And we also picked up a lot of ex-Hope Bay dogs from Admiralty Bay. I think we took about 18 or 20 dogs down from Admiralty Bay.
So that was the first time that dogs had been kept at Halley?
Yes.
In 61?
I believe so. They did have one dog there, a runt, which had been picked up from somewhere. I'm not quite sure from
where.
As
a pet?
Yes, as a pet.
Yeah. Mm. How did you look after the dogs Because were they on the surface all the time?
No, the coming down was a good idea. Bringing them down on the ship was a good thing in that it got used the FIDs on board. It was their first acquaintance with dogs. They got used to them, feeding them, feeding the puppies and so on. We brought them ashore, we had them on spans, and as the winter came on and the new hut was drifting over, some tunnels were made alongside one edge of the hut. Canvas sheeting was put down first, which was quickly covered with ice, and it formed an ice cave with little bits of little kennels inside for them to get into. So they lived inside. This was something new to me, and I wasn't sure personally whether it was a good thing or not. I think now it probably was a good thing in that it kept them a bit warmer than they would have been outside, but I did feel that they were bred to live outside whatever the weather. However, it doesn't do them any harm to be inside.
They weren't down there for 9 months solid, though, were they?
No, they were just down for the midwinter period, and then brought out again onto the.
So they would be under the snow for 6 to 8 weeks or so, were they?
Oh, at least that, yes.
Yeah.
Mm, yes, at least.
Without coming up.
Mm, mm. Oh, they were brought out occasionally for exercise. Yes, yes, they were.
Right.
Someone would bring out two dogs at a time and take them out and round the hut a few times and then back again, yes.
Walking the dog?
Yes, yes, indeed. Mm. Mm.
And they didn't seem to mind their incarceration?
Didn't seem to bother them at all, no, no. They still barked and still made a fuss when they got the food.
Mm.
It was fairly messy.
Yes.
You know, the blubber got around a bit down below.
So were you having to muck them out?
Not to that extent. We were just except taking out the odd scraps, you know, the skins. They always left the skins with a certain amount of blubber on. So we had to take that, clear that out occasionally. But mainly the blubber just sank into the ice and snow.
What about the toilet?
The dog's toilet. Yes, well, we hoped that would happen when they were outside on the walk. otherwise, it got buried.
Right, okay. They had a bit of competition, didn't they, the dogs, because you had some muskeg tractors at Halley that time.
Yes, we did have the muskegs.
Were they successful?
Which I would say is successful, yes, very useful vehicles. Certainly they towed up large loads of stores from the foot of the ice shelf up to where we were beginning, where we were living, including all this building material. They brought all that up, which was laid out in long rows for weeks on end as it was brought into use. Yes, they were very useful for that. And, of course, Colin and Dennis Ardus used them both to go to the Tottens.
Mm.
I travelled on them occasionally. Travelling inside the cab was very comfortable, but outside, sitting on the back, was a cold, drafty experience. And you had to be careful not to put your hand on anywhere near the exhaust.
There was a muskeg tragedy a couple of years later at Halley.
Yes, one of them went through a crevasse, I think, but I believe they towed it out. I'm not sure. I can't remember. I don't know about that.
Okay. Mm. My question really is to do with whether at that point that anybody was aware that muskeg travel was a bit dodgy.
I'm sure they were.
Went first.
I'm sure they were. Whenever Colin and Dennis travelled, in them. They were linked together by a steel cable, and one went ahead, certainly, so that the rear one could, at least in theory, have held the front one had it gone through a good pass, yes.
So they always went in pair, in a pair?
Yes.
As a pair?
Not at the, not around the base, but travelling away, yes. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. We've got a couple of minutes left, and I usually ask about scary moments. Now, you've told me about one or two of yours already, but it may be that you've discussed these as well. But apparently at Admiralty Bay, you were walking across an icy slope, and you lost it. Is that right?
Yes. There was a slope between the base and Plaza Point. There was not a steep ice slope, but a fairly gentle gradient, and I'd walked across it several times, easily enough. But on this particular day, the ice had become glazed, and I didn't have the best of boots on. And I got about halfway across and realised that I was slipping. I could no longer get a grip on the ice. And I started sliding down towards Plaza Point. And eventually I was on my behind and sliding down, no means of stopping. And I'm coming towards some spiky bits of rock. And I thought, well, if I hit that with my behind, it's going to do me some damage. So just as I got towards it, I forced myself up onto my feet and was glissading down on my feet. As I got to the rocks, I had to take up my speed running over these jagged bits of rocks, which I managed to do, and eventually managed to slow down and walk. But that was certainly a stupid, silly moment I wouldn't have liked to have had again. And my third moment, again, was a bit silly. A huge iceberg came into Admiralty Bay, and it, leading from it, there was a long spur under the water, rising up to a little ice island. And I was with Adrian Wensley Walker in the boat, and I thought it would be a good photograph if I went onto the ice island and Wensley sailed in front of the big berg with his boat, and I got a photograph of him. So we put that into action. I got out onto the bit of ice with my camera, and Wensley went off and motored slowly along in front of the iceberg. I put up my camera to my eye to take a photograph and found there was no film in it, or the film had been finished. And also, the little island I was in was bobbing up and down like nobody's business, and I was being in danger of being flung off into the sea. So I shouted, "Come back, Wensley," and I got into the boat again.
Did moments like that, did you ever have a cold sweat later? Did you?
I don't know about cold sweat. Certainly I thought, well, that was a stupid thing to do. Don't do it again.
The story of Fids is littered with moments like that.
I mean, previously and often I'd been across much steeper ice slopes with a pair of crampons on. No problem at all. So I should have had crampons with me and put them on.
It does strike me sometimes it's miraculous that not more Fids met a sticky end.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad he didn't.
So am I, yes.
Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.